This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. This week is the finale in our four-week series visiting with some of the finest and most impactful pianists on the scene. Today we visit with a pianist we featured last Friday evening on our Music from the Institute for Advanced Study concert series, Canadian artist David Jaubert. He has won many awards and accolades both for his concert performances and his recordings, which include French music of Fauré, Poulenc, and Satie, American music by Crigliano, Jevsky, and John Adams, piano music of Shostakovich, and he's recorded chamber music with young outstanding artists of his generation. But his recording and concert performances of Bach's monumental Goldberg Variations is what brought him to Princeton and to our airwaves. You're listening to him perform the famous opening aria, or theme, to Bach's structural masterpiece, and then we'll hear the first three variations. We'll hear him discuss this high watermark work for any pianist, and my guest, being a Canadian pianist, also has to take into account Glenn Gould's iconic recordings. In addition to all this, my guest has also been named one of the 15 best pianists from that country, our neighbor to the north. The press has dubbed him a deeply musical pianist and a virtuoso in the best sense of the word. He's also a wonderful communicator, which might make sense as he's also a commentator on CBC Radio. I caught up with him on the stage of Wolfensohn Hall at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton between his performances of Bach's Goldberg Variations last November. Thank you.
David Jalbert. We're on the stage, as we normally are, with artists who appear at Wolfenson Hall on the campus of the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton between concerts, the Friday night concert, which I was at last night with you, and tonight's concert. The program that you're presenting here at the IAS is a single work, and one of the most fascinating aspects, I think, is that it, as well, we're going to talk about this up front, is it kind of speaks to you as a pianist and an artist. The one work is Bach's Goldberg Variations. How does a work of this magnitude, length, difficulty make it into the repertoire of a pianist in general? Not every pianist embraces this piece. What's the decision process? How do you start learning this piece and then decide I'm going to learn it in its entirety and then have it as part of my repertoire?
Well, it doesn't happen by accident. One has to plan on learning the Goldberg Variations because, as you say, it takes a staggering amount of time. So when I planned to learn it, I already had plans to record it for Atma, my company. I wanted to make this a multi-year project because, of course, if you're going to record it, you have to plan lots of concerts to perform it before and then hopefully after. So it was a carefully thought out artistic project that I made possible for myself with the help of just some organization, making sure that I had time to learn it before the first performances, because it takes so much time, right? It's you have to rewrite half the piece for single keyboard piano, yeah, because it was written for a harpsichord with two keyboards. And because of that, it's not a piece that you can learn like you would learn any other piece. You can't just read off the page and put fingerings on and figure out how to do it technically. You have to actually write your own arrangement.
Are there printed just piano editions?
No.
No, there aren't. So you really approach this and say, I'm going to make this happen for me as an individual artist.
It takes time. It takes time. You have to be very willing to put the effort in.
I might be curious, just because we're talking about this piece, from the time you said, I'm going to learn the Goldbergs, to the time when you had every single variation, did arias learned, what kind of time span are we talking about?
Well, several months or almost a year between me saying I would learn them and then the first performance. Now, that's very different from starting to learn them.
Right.
And there's a funny story here in that my agent, who naturally issues promotion materials a year ahead of time, had issued materials trying to promote for the following season that I would be performing the Goldberg Variations. Now, someone went ahead and hired me at shorter notice for the same season for a recital and didn't mention anything to my agent, but went ahead and put out posters and pamphlets that I was going to be playing the Goldberg Variations. Yeah. This was way before I'd planned on performing them, and in fact, before I'd started learning them. And I was just back from a tour playing Schumann's Carnival and, you know, like a different program. And that left me basically less than a month to actually learn the whole thing, memorize it, and perform it. I mean, it went. It wasn't great. But I tried to get out of it, actually, and program the same program with Schumann's Carnival. But someone was playing that in the same season just a few weeks before. Basically, I had no way out. And I thought, well, it'll be terrifying, but then I'll have the notes learned and life will be better.
Right. I've heard other pianists do it, but sitting here listening to you play it last night, I was thinking, how do pianists learn this piece? Do you, like, get up each day and say, today's variation 16, I'm not going to sleep tonight? Can you learn it in chunks like that, or do you have to group them, or can you just sort of rip apart box piece and learn it that way, or do you have to learn it in big chunks so you get the whole flow of it?
Yeah, I tend to go with the flow a little more. I don't try to get everything to perfection right away when I learn something. I try to get a sense of the whole arc of the piece a little more. But eventually you have to do exactly what you say, which is like, I'm not going to bed. I'm not going to the bathroom until this is memorized.
That's incentive.
I'm not getting coffee.
Especially if you had like 2 cups of coffee in the morning and I'm not going to the bathroom. So
I'm not getting up off the bench until this is learned or until this works. You have to make this happen otherwise.
Yeah, you said how the score is for the two manual harpsichord. That's the way Bach wrote it. But there's also an openness to the score for dynamics, all kinds of ways that are left open, as so much music from the Baroque is. So pianists have to make decisions, and I wanted you to talk about your decisions. Each variation is structured just like the aria, the theme, where there's an A part, the A part is repeated, there's a B part, the B part is repeated.
Mm-hmm.
So that second repeat, which would have been the want and norm back in the Baroque, the artist would, what we would call ornament or improvise bits in there to flower it up, keep of interest, show their chops.
Right.
So that's what you had to do. Your interpretation last night, I heard more of it, very well done, by the way, I've heard more of it than I've heard in others. Talk us through adding that, how you build that into something of a work like this, which is 250 years old.
Yeah. Well, that's the aspect of the piece that is so unique and so interesting for an artist, is the leeway that you have over such a long structure to create something that's really yours, and literally in terms of the notes that you can add in. I mean, you can change the text a little bit. Of course, there's other ways to create variety than adding ornaments. You can change the dynamics, the voicing, highlight a different part in a different hand, perhaps. Mm. You can change the character, the lighting, if you will. So all these decisions are really, really interesting, and you can experiment kind of your entire life with different ideas. And that I found really fascinating, terrifying, daunting, for sure. But this is the part of the job with the Goldberg that I found the most challenging and the most interesting. Of course, you can apply that also to a Bach French suite and to a partita. but the sheer scale of the Goldberg and the tradition that it has of being performed in this way by great pianists with great imagination for ornaments just makes that all the more exciting and enticing.
You mentioned last night on the stage how, you know, some interpretations can over-romanticize and it sounds, just sounds like a set of Chopin etudes. But the Chopin etudes have meticulous pedaling and all this kind of stuff in it, and this doesn't. So how do you choose your ornamentations or your changes or what you add to the score to know that you're within the boundaries? Do you want to be within the boundaries of what Bach might have recognized, but also add your own personality into it, something that is definitely David Jaubert's? You know what I'm saying? There's a real weird balance there.
Yeah, what I think I mean about the Chopin etude comparison is mostly the choices of tempos sometimes. Yeah. Because there are tempos that we can reach, we virtuoso pianists who play, you know, all these romantic concertos. We can reach speeds that were completely unthinkable in Bach's day, and there's no way that he wrote this music with these kinds of tempos in mind on a harpsichord. So that gives you a little hint as to, you know, what kind of tempo he would have had in mind, or a kind of character for each variation. Most of the variations you can identify to a style of keyboard music from the time, right? It's an Allemande, it's a Courant, you know, all these dances. The theme is a sarabande.
Right.
That, if you look carefully, gives you a framework, I think. And I tried to go after that and to use that as my way of acknowledging what I think Bach meant with these individual movements. I'm sure everyone goes through the same process and comes to different conclusions, naturally. But to me, that's the norms. That's where the frame is. I try to go within what I think Bach might have wanted stylistically in each piece. Now, I'm playing it on a piano, so he never heard a piano in his life. I think he would have loved the piano.
Sure, he would have.
Yeah. But already you were taking it away from its original instrument.
Right.
So all this that I'm saying, I don't want it to sound too pretentious, just a little pretentious. Because, of course, I'm not playing it on a harpsichord, so I'm taking it out of its natural habitat already. So I'm already a monster. Then I just try to mitigate that fact by making it as stylistically accurate as I believe it should be in my own way.
Dipping in once again to my guest David Jaubert's recording of Bach's Goldberg Variations, here is the midpoint of the work, Variation 16, cast by Bach as a classic French overture with a stately opening section followed by a quick tempo second half. Thank you.
there are a number of pieces by Bach which we're not sure or we know that he composed. And even in the Klavierübung, the piano exercise where this comes from, the Goldberg is found as one of those. We don't really think that he composed these pieces to have any idea they'd be performed as a unit or a piece or in front of a single audience. However, this piece has real interesting signposts in it to show that Bach really wanted this to be played in its entirety, beginning mm-hmm. to last note. And it also is tied up with Bach's fascination, which we now know was real in so much of his work, of numerology and all these kind of weird little things in there. Talk about the fact that Bach obviously wanted this to be played extant, beginning to end, and how he put little things in there to give little signposts as the variations go on of this is what I'm doing, here's the middle. I mean, all that kind of stuff. Talk to them. It's fascinating.
Well, obviously, I think you're right that it was meant to be performed through. I think you see that in the shape of the work, right? It's what we call progressive variations. That's the term that became used, I guess, later. Mm. And that's a technique that we find in Mozart and Beethoven's variations and pretty much anybody's, in that the tempos initially are sort of moderate. The variations are pretty chilled out, the beginning, if you will. And there's a crescendo in intensity throughout the length of the whole work, whereas like the last few variations are extremely virtuosic, right? And of course, there's slow movements interspersed throughout the work. But the general arc of the work is one of getting more and more virtuosic and big sounding until that final effect that's so strong, right, so potent, when after the climax of the 30th variation, suddenly we come back to the near silence of the opening aria. It's a moment that's so prized in the history of music and that is insanely influential in the history of music afterwards. You find that in those variations by Beethoven in the late sonatas, in Opus 109, for instance, when the beautiful theme comes back quietly at the end. I think that's enormously influential. Also, well, there are markers, as you said, throughout the work. The first half, so variation 15, ends with the first variation in G minor, right, because all the variations are in G major. They all have the same bass line, so there are only three variations in G minor. The first one is number 15. It's very slow lyrical. It reminds one of the Eleison from the Mass in B minor, and it ends on a suspension on the very highest note of the harpsichord in those days, and then there's a little pause, and the second half begins with an overture, right? A French overture, of all things, very noble with the dotted rhythms to kick off the second half, if you will, of the marathon. Yeah. And from then on, I find that the variations flow into one another better in the second half. It really feels like it's easier to pace yourself from one variation to the next, even though they're even more virtuosic. Somehow it feels like each movement calls into the next one. And this buildup, I find, is not accidental. It's really all part of what you mentioned. The structure of the work is really meant as a giant crescendo towards the end of the work.
Yeah, and the structures you mentioned last night, that every third variation is in canon, the intervals expand. Right. You didn't mention, and maybe no one wants to really make the tie or not sure, that the bass line that repeats over and over is 32 notes long. There's variations. I mean, it's all everywhere. I mean, Bach, yeah, just his love of numbers and working it into his pieces. This piece is full of it. Because the length of it being performed in its entirety is great. I'm just wondering, there's other piano pieces that are, long too, but as you play this for audiences, you've done it so many times, how do you know that the audience is with you?
it's hard to gauge. You try not to think about that, ideally. I always know that they're with me by the end because I really feel like it's a piece that fundamentally works in the performance. There are moments throughout where sometimes you wonder, but hopefully you don't have time to think about that, and perhaps that's not true, and people are allowed to shuffle in their seats when they're sitting there for an hour and 20 minutes nonstop. God knows I would too. So I think usually people are quite into it.
What's interesting about the Goldberg is that there isn't a lot of shuffling. There aren't these huge breaks between movements, mm-mm, and you sort of just start bouncing on the wave of each variation, and there isn't really. The performances I've been to, it's quite amazing how it holds everybody's attention. So I mentioned at the top that there's different aspects about you play this work, you're Canadian.
I didn't do that on purpose.
You didn't do it on purpose. It's not your fault. But, of course, this looms the figure of, you know, Pache to Roslyn Turk, but probably the pianist who, by playing this work, brought it to more people's ears than would have ever happened, and that's, of course, Glenn Gould, another fellow Canadian pianist. So how does his recordings, his interpretation, his stamp on this piece affect you? Does it loom large among Canadian pianists or all pianists? Does it factor in about whether they want to take it up? I mean, what does it mean to you? What does it mean, as far as you can tell, to a larger group of pianists?
It means as little as possible to me, because, of course, I love his recordings of the Goldbergs, but I wasn't someone who grew up worshipping Glenn Gould. And a lot of people did, you know. Evgeny Kissin, I know, refused to play Bach for a long time because he was so, you know, enamored of Gould's recordings, he thought he couldn't touch the stuff. I didn't grow up in that style. I grew up admiring, say, Murray Pereira or Martha Argerich more than I did Glenn Gould. So perhaps that spared me a little being intimidated by Gould's recordings. There's also the fact that I perform the Goldbergs literally, in that I do all the repeats with ornaments, and Gould doesn't. His first recording from 1955, which is so, so fast, and where there aren't any repeats and lasts 39 minutes and 50 seconds or something, is so exciting. It's a bit like rabbits humping, but as far as the Goldbergs go. But it's very atypical performance of the Goldberg variations. You know, his recordings really predate the modern performance practice era, right? Mm-hmm. And in a way, his version from 1955 was completely out there in terms of what we would nowadays consider proper performance practice, right, with all the repeats ornamentation. Tempos that are, you know, kind of matching the style of each dance or each movement. And then there's the 1981 recording, which he did at the end of his life, which is very different. Has some repeats, but still few repeats. Mm-hmm. And then is kind of the polar opposite of the first one in that it's outrageously slow for the most part of it, right? And rather heavy. Mm-hmm. So he's kind of at the two poles of his own version, his own vision of the piece, which is great, and they're both immensely enjoyable recordings. But it wasn't the kind of track that I was putting myself into when I decided to learn this piece. So being Canadian, I guess I'm a Quebecer.
Yeah.
We don't grow up thinking of ourselves as Canadians. I mean, I'm definitely Canadian. But you don't realize that until you leave Quebec or you leave Canada.
Right.
Later on, then you're like, oh, yeah, Canada's pretty awesome. That's nice.
I was curious because that comparison will always be made as long as you play the Goldberg variations.
Yeah, sure.
And nothing against the Gould interpretations. Many people hold them dear to their hearts, probably because they did introduce them to this great music.
But also, he was one of the first people to play it on piano.
Exactly.
Because it was just not possible.
But it would be fair to say that we've moved on from his interpretations to something that is more akin to what Bach probably intended or thought would be heard.
So we'll save the end of Bach's Great Goldberg Variations for the end of our program, as performed by my guest David Gelbert, but here he is in Variations 27 through 29. Thank you.
List of 15 of the greatest pianists of all time, not just walking around. Which obviously Gould is on that list, but I'm
but,
sure.
But in Canada, you it, mean that?
Well, sure. Okay, but I mean, the list is going to have Gould. It'll have people like, you know, Marc-Andre Hamelin, and yeah. Angela Hewitt is on there. Probably even, I'm not sure she is, but Diana Krall might be on there, I assume. As the
actually, no.
That's a wild think... oversight, but.
Yeah, sure, I like it a lot, but it's all classical.
It's all classical.
Piano people, yeah.
But when you found that out, is that a source of pride for you? Is there a camaraderie among. Last summer I had a whole series of Canadian composers.
Oh, yeah.
They're all very different styles, but there's kind of this Canadian pride, this sort of camaraderie of. This is who we are, and we know each other. And is there the same among Canadian pianists and making this list?
I think so. Well, the list itself, you know, it's a great honor to be on it. At first, I was almost embarrassed because I couldn't believe it. You know, I think I was on holiday in the Dominican Republic. I got this email. I was like, what? So, no, it's an immense honor that someone thought that. It was the CBC who drew up this list. That's all I can say. And people are very friendly. I mean, we're Canadians, we're supposed to be. And we try very hard to live up to that. But yeah, the people who are still alive and who I know who are on this list are all, you know, wonderful pianists and great people. Mm. Yeah.
But is there also this, you do know each other? I mean, is it a kind of a community thing where you know each other because you have this country source in common? And
yes, I think there's a lot of...
You play a lot of the same venues and play
yes,
a lot of the same festivals,
yes.
Blah, blah, blah.
So we know a lot of the same people.
Right.
So right away, if you meet one of these pianists whom you never have met before, you have all these, you know, common references, people that you know. So... yeah, I think there is a camaraderie there that's kind of preformed and just waiting to happen if you get to know each other for the first time.
Well, I mean, you got put on the list not by chance. You built a really nice career both as a soloist with orchestra, chamber musician. The solo career, the repertoire you perform is pretty wide-ranging. I mean, we'll go back to Bach, go all the way up to many living composers, your first recording, or one of your first recordings, well, what was your first recording, commercial recording of John Corigliano and Frederick Jevsky. Also, you were talking about from the stage last night how you did a program where you've just been working on the piano transcriptions of the Stravinsky ballets, Prokofiev's Romeo and Juliet, which are fiendishly difficult. And
thanks for understanding.
Does your repertoire tend to go towards things that are extremely challenging, and is that your comfort zone? Or
yeah, that's a strange question. Psychologically, maybe I'm a bit of a masochist. Always have been. It's true, I've always gravitated towards a difficult repertoire. I'm not sure whether it's the rep that's difficult or it's just me finding everything very difficult. But yet, it's music that I groove to, literally. It's music that captivates me, and that's the criteria, right? That's what will make me decide that I have to play this. As for the Stravinsky and Prokofiev ballets, that's the next CD. I recorded those early September, so it's supposed to come out next fall in Atma. So that was very, very hard to make, and especially because I had all these performances lined up in the summer where I would play, you know, not just one ballet at the end of the program, say Petrushka to finish the program, but also Firebird on it, and also Romeo and Juliet on it, which is really not meant to be done. I mean, these are program enders, right? And I ended up with recitals full of program enders. That was pretty brutal.
No way, there's more to come.
it was hard, but interesting.
Does that go to what you spoke to, challenging yourself? I mean, you started really young on the piano, you're like four or something, but does that come from your parents or the encouragement or your teachers, or is it just you that you tend to pick? And not every pianist is like this. You tend to look towards things that are going to put you in a box until you find your way out of it.
Yeah, well, the reason that makes me do that is always the music, right?
Right.
I always loved Prokofiev. Prokofiev is the reason I became a pianist. Somehow, when I was 10, I discovered Prokofiev, and that was more than Mozart or Beethoven or Bach was the switch, you know, for me. It was like, yeah, I want to play this music. I need to be able to play the Prokofiev Third Concerto. So that made me want to practice and motivated me. So the love of Prokofiev was always there, but some years back I really fell into Stravinsky hard and suddenly kind of got it, and I found that I just had to put my hands in it.
Right.
And Petrushka is, of course, one of the most luminous and imaginative pieces ever written, even after recording it and, you know, losing, I'm sure, 10 pounds, having to perform it and record it. I'm still totally in love with the piece. I could still go home and put on a recording of the full ballet, not on the piano, naturally,
the
orchestra version, and still love every second of it. I mean, I can go on the treadmill listening to Petrushka. That's how exciting I think the music is.
Does your treading pick up? You change with the tempos, I guess?
Yeah, that's it. Motivates you. It's faster.
But there has to be a real confidence in your technique, confidence in you, to tackle some of these pieces. I mean, not everybody can be Maurizio Pollini. So, you know, that's the way it is.
Including me.
Well,
I don't feel like I have the technical means of a Pollini or, you know, so many other great virtuosos. I mean, at the same time, I do play all this music and I guess it works. But I certainly feel like I have to work at it. Maybe they do too, but you know, these people impress me. I guess they impress most pianists, we impress each other anyway. But I have to work at it. I find it certainly very, very difficult to play Petrushka as fast as Pollini, and I'm not sure I manage or try, really. But I enjoy the kind of work, and I certainly feel like I know how to make it work. I have a very objective conception of technique. You know, we have two arms and two hands and 10 fingers. And if this guy can do this and you can't, it's because he's physically doing the right gestures and you're not. So you just have to figure out what it is about your movement that hampers you, right? That creates tension, takes time away. And I think that's what makes me, hopefully, a good teacher. Because I find that I can take a student who doesn't have much technique to begin with, and by the end of a couple of years, he can play pretty much anything.
And students can also pick up on a teacher's confidence, too, of being able to be able to do this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, perhaps. Yeah,
and then
you
have that.
From a recording by my guest of French music, works by Eric Satie and Francis Poulenc, here are two of the latter's improvisations, both homages, number 12 to Schubert and number 15 to the great singer Edith Piaf, performed by David Jaubert. Thank you.
So last thing, and it's also an aspect, at least it was of your performance last night, and I got the feeling it's an aspect of your performance overall. In this day where you have program notes and anybody coming to the concert on beforehand or on their phone before or during can look up information about the music. You speak to the audience. You're very good at it. You're very light nature. You know, you're humorous and you make everybody feel at ease and you give information about it. So communicating with the audience before a program you do. This wasn't always done decades ago. It wasn't seen as proper. But it is for you. I mean, what part of this does this play for you in your normal concert giving, your recital giving? Is it important that you connect with the audience a little bit before you put your hands on the keyboard?
It depends on the situation. Okay. I find that with the Goldberg Variations, it matters. I don't do it for me. In a way, I enjoy doing it, but it's very hard to then turn around and play the piano, you know? Because you can be warmed up, you can be focused. You go out and you talk for 5 minutes and you're not anymore. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to make that switch. But with the Goldberg, I get so much feedback from the audience afterwards, usually telling me how much that helped them get through the piece, enjoy it, find their waymarks through it, and understand what's going on and how it changes their experience of listening to it, that I find it kind of a duty to do it.
You can also assume with a piece of that length,
yeah,
you're not going to get any response from them, unless you hear the fidgeting and everything you're talking about, but you're not going to get any response from them until over an hour later.
Yeah.
So by talking to them, it lets you gauge the audience a little bit, maybe, before you sit down? Do you find that?
It does a little bit. I mean, it doesn't help me. I mean, whether they're wonderful or cold and threatening, you know, it won't really change anything. When I sit down on the piano, I'll be nervous because I have to play the Goldberg for an hour and 20 minutes.
Right.
So that does happen. It does give you a sense of the audience. But even if the audience puts you at ease with their reaction to you talking to them, somehow it's still the same when you sit down and you have to play it.
You mentioned the next recording being the Russian ballets, but what else might be coming up, not even on record, just in recital or concert? Maybe something that you haven't done before, something you're looking forward to? Or is there something you still haven't gotten your hands on, which you, the next few years, say?
Oh, there's always something. Yeah. But in the next few years, I'm going to work through all the Prokofiev sonatas. Which I've been wanting to do all my life, as I hinted at, I think. And now I've decided to make it official and have recitals planned out to go through the cycle.
Well, that'd be great.
I hope so.
I close all my Cadenza interviews by asking my guests the same two questions, and the first is just a hypothetical, which says, if you could chat like we've been chatting with someone from the past, you never had a chance to. First name that pops in when I ask that.
Somehow Mozart. Yeah. Just because he seems like someone you'd like to chat with. But my fantasy about talking to composers from the past is actually to have them here right now and get them to listen to the music of the people who came after them. That is what I would really love to see. I want to see Mozart listening to Rachmaninoff's Third Concerto. You know, I would just love to, you know, see Mozart listening to Rite of Spring. You know, somehow that's the thing that gets me off completely, is just to think of these guys from the past, of Bach, Beethoven, seeing what they opened the doors to.
Yeah, and after their initial musical realigning shock, they probably would hear their influence in that music.
Yeah, and I think they'd go nuts. Just the excitement and perhaps rage. All these things combined would be fascinating to behold. Yeah. You'd have to take it one step at a time. You know, you start with Schubert, then, Chopin, Schumann, and, you know, let them digest that for a few weeks, and then Wagner.
Well, Mozart knew the whole piano-playing public thing so well, playing all his concertos. He probably would have said, let me see his hands after hearing the Rachmaninoff. Let me see the size of his hands. How does he do that? Final question is a non-musical question. Everybody I interview in Cadenza fills their life with music. You're very busy, not only concertizing, but you do teach in Ottawa and all those. When you have to do something that is non-musical, take yourself away from it, pleasure, relaxation, enjoyment, but can get a little respite, what do? When you need to just step away?
I've been a U.S. politics buff for 20 years by now. It's been a fascination of mine, so I tend to know way more than I should about U.S. politics.
Didn't explode in the last few weeks?
It exploded.
Yeah.
It's still not back together.
Yeah.
But I could probably name at least half of the U.S. senators. I mean, that's how crazy I am. So that's one thing. And I guess tennis, avid tennis watcher and player.
Well, David Gilbert, thanks for taking some time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Pianist David Gilbert. You can find out more about him at his website. David Gilbert is JALBERT.com. His recordings are on the Canadian Atma Classique label. You can find there his Bach Goldberg variations and recordings of Fauré, Poulenc, Satie, American composers Carigliano, Zhevsky, and Adams, also Shostakovich, and soon, as you heard, his Prokofiev. Atma is distributed by Naxos. Check them out at Naxos.com. I'll leave you with the always miraculous ending to Bach's Goldberg Variations, the final Quodlibet variation, and then the restatement of the theme, the aria, performed by my guest today, David Gilbert. Programming note, I will post David Gilbert's performance of the Goldberg Variations from the Institute for Advanced Study, which we broadcast last Friday, on our website next to the webcast of this program. As always, I'm glad you were in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network and WWFM.org.